The final approach to the dirt runway, which Stan called the Proverbia Airport, was bumpy and scary. The Navajo came down, feeling its way through the stacks of angry air, and landed with a final jarring thump. When it did, Sam uttered a pinched scream. His eyes flew open. Naomi had been waiting patiently for something like this. She leaned forward at once, ignoring the seatbelt which cut into her middle, and put her arms around him. She ignored his raised arms and first instinctive drawing away, just as she ignored the first hot and unpleasant outrush of horrified breath. She had comforted a great many drunks in the grip of the DTs. This wasn't much different. She could feel his heart as she pressed against him. It seemed to leap and skitter just below his shirt. "It's okay. Sam, it's okay. It's just me, and you're back. It was a dream. You're back." For a moment he continued trying to push himself into his seat. Then he collapsed, limp. His hands came up and hugged her with panicky tightness. "Naomi," he said in a harsh, choked voice. "Naomi. Oh, Naomi. Oh, dear Jesus. What a nightmare I had. What a terrible dream." Stan had radioed ahead, and someone had come out to turn on the runway landing lights. They were taxiing between them toward the end of the runway now. They had not beaten the rain after all. It drummed hollowly on the body of the plane. Up front, Stan Soames was bellowing out something which might have been Camptown Races. "Was it a nightmare?" Naomi asked, drawing back from Sam so she could look into his bloodshot eyes.
"Yes. But it was also true. All true."
"Was it the library policeman, Sam? Your library policeman?"
"Yes," he whispered, and pressed his face into her hair.
"Do you know who he is? Do you know who he is now, Sam?" After a long, long moment, Sam whispered,
"I know."
Stan Soames took a look at Sam's face as he and Naomi stepped from the plane and was instantly contrite.
"Sorry, it was so rough. I really thought we'd beat the rain. It's just that with a headwind..."
"I'll be okay," Sam said. He was, in fact, looking better already. "Yes," Naomi said. "He'll be fine. Thank you, Stan. Thank you so much. And Dave thanks you, too."
"Well, as long as you got what you needed."
"We did," Sam assured him. "We really did."
"Well, let's walk around the end of the runway," Stan told him. "That boggy place would suck you right into your waist if you tried the shortcut this evening. Come into the house. We'll have coffee. There's some apple pie, too, I think."
Sam glanced at his watch. It was 7:15.
"We'll have to take a rain check, Stan," he said. "Naomi and I have to get these books into town right away."
"You ought to at least come in and dry off. You're going to be soaked by the time you get to your car."
Naomi shook her head. "It's very important."
"Yeah," Stan said. "From the look of you two, I'd say it is. Just remember that you promised to tell me the story."
"We will, too," Sam said. He glanced at Naomi and saw his own thought reflected in her eyes. "If we're still alive to tell it." Sam drove, resisting an urge to tromp the gas pedal all the way to the floor. He was worried about Dave. Driving off the road and turning Naomi's car over in the ditch wasn't a very effective way of showing concern, however, and the rain in which they had landed was now a downpour, driven by a freshening wind. The wipers could not keep up with it, even on high, and the headlights petered out after 20 feet. Sam dared drive no more than 25. He glanced at his watch, then looked over at where Naomi sat, with the bookshop bag in her lap.
I hope we can make it by 8, he said. But I don't know.
Just do the best you can, Sam. Headlights, wavery as the lights of an undersea diving bell, loomed ahead. Sam slowed to 10 miles an hour and squeezed left as a 10-wheeler rumbled by, a half-glimpsed hulk in the rainy darkness. Can you talk about it, the dream you had?
I could, but I'm not going to, he said. Not now. It's the wrong time.
Naomi considered this, then nodded her head. All right.
I can tell you this much. Dave was right when he said children make the best meal. And he was right when he said that what she really lives on is fear.
They had reached the outskirts of town. A block further on, they drove through their first light-controlled intersection. Through the Datsun's windshield, the signal was only a bright green smear dancing in the air above them. A corresponding smear danced across the smooth, wet hide of the pavement.
I need to make one stop before we get to the library, Sam said. The Piggly Wiggly's on the way, isn't it?
Yes, but if we're going to meet Dave behind the library at 8, we really don't have much time to spare. Like it or not, this is go-slow weather.
I know, but this won't take long.
What do you need?
I'm not sure, he said, but I think I'll know it when I see it.
She glanced at him, and for the second time he found himself amazed by the fox-like, fragile quality of her beauty, and unable to understand why he had never seen it before today.
Well, you dated her, didn't you? You must have seen something.
Except he hadn't. He had dated her because she was pretty, presentable, unattached, and approximately his own age. He had dated her because bachelors in cities, which were really just overgrown small towns, were supposed to date, if they were bachelors interested in making a place for themselves in the local business community, that was. If you didn't date, people, some people, might think you were
a policeman.
A little bit funny.
I was a little funny, he thought. On second thought, I was a lot funny. But whatever I was, I think I'm a little different now. And I am seeing her. There's that. I'm really seeing her.
For Naomi's part, she was struck by the strained whiteness of his face and the look of tension around his eyes and mouth. He looked strange, but he no longer looked terrified. Naomi thought, he looks like a man who has been granted the opportunity to return to his worst nightmare with some powerful weapon in his hands. She thought it was a face she might be falling in love with, and this made her deeply uneasy. This stop, it's important, isn't it?
I think so, yes.
5 minutes later, he stopped in the parking lot of the Piggly Wiggly store. Sam was out at once and dashing for the door through the rain. Halfway there, he stopped. A telephone booth stood at the side of the parking lot, the same booth undoubtedly where Dave had made his call to the Junction City Sheriff's Office all those years before. The call made from that booth had not killed Ardelia, but it had driven her off for a good long while. Sam stepped into it. The light went on. There was nothing to see. It was just a phone booth with numbers and graffiti scribbled on the steel walls. The telephone book was gone. And Sam remembered Dave saying,
this was back in the days when you could sometimes still find a telephone book in a telephone booth, if you were lucky.
Then he glanced at the floor and saw what he had been looking for. It was a wrapper. He picked it up, smoothed it out, and read what was written there in the dingy overhead light. Bullseye red licorice. From behind him, Naomi beat an impatient tattoo on the Datsun's horn. Sam left the booth with the wrapper in his hand, waved to her, and ran into the store through the pouring rain. The Piggly Wiggly clerk looked like a young man who had been cryogenically frozen in 1969 and thawed out just that week. His eyes had the red and slightly glazed look of the veteran dope smoker. His hair was long and held with a rawhide Jesus thong. On one pinky, he wore a silver ring beaten into the shape of the peace sign. Beneath his piggly-wiggly tunic was a billowy shirt in an extravagant flower print. Pinned to the collar was a button which read, "My face is leaving in 5 minutes. Be on it." Sam doubted if this was a sentiment of which the store manager would have approved. But it was a rainy night, and the store manager was nowhere in sight. Sam was the only customer in the place, and the clerk watched him with a bemused and uninvolved eye as he went to the candy rack and began to pick up packages of bullseye red licorice. Sam took the entire stock, about 20 packages.
"You sure you got enough, dude?"
the clerk asked him as Sam approached the counter and laid his trove upon it.
"I think there might be another carton or two of the stuff out back in the storeroom. I know how it is when you get a serious case of the munchies."
"This should do. Ring it up, would you? I'm in a hurry."
"Yeah, it's the hurry-ass world," the clerk said.
His fingers tripped over the keys of the NCR register with the dreamy slowness of the habitually stoned. There was a rubber band lying on the counter beside a baseball card display. Sam picked it up. "Could I have this?"
"Be my guest, dude. Consider it a gift from me, the Prince of Piggly Wiggly, to you, the Lord of Licorice, on a rainy Monday evening."
As Sam slipped the rubber band over his wrist, it hung there like a loose bracelet. A gust of wind, strong enough to rattle the windows, shook the building. The lights overhead flickered.
"Whoa, dude," the Prince of Piggly Wiggly said, looking up. "That wasn't in the forecast. Just showers, they said."
He looked back down at the register.
1541.
Sam handed him a 20 with a small, bitter smile. "This stuff was a hell of a lot cheaper when I was a kid."
"Inflation sucks the big one, all right,"
the clerk agreed. He was slowly returning to that soft spot in the ozone where he had been when Sam came in.
"You must really like that stuff, man. Me, I stick to good old Mars bars."
"Like it?" Sam laughed as he pocketed his change. "I hate it. This is for someone else." He laughed again. "Call it a present." The clerk saw something in Sam's eyes then, and suddenly took a big, hurried step away from him, almost knocking over a display of Skull Bandits. Sam looked at the clerk's face curiously, and decided not to ask for a bag. He gathered up the packages, distributed them at random in the pockets of the sport coat he had put on 1,000 years ago, and left the store. Cellophane crackled busily in his pockets with every stride he took. Naomi had slipped behind the wheel, and she drove the rest of the way to the library. As she pulled out of the Piggly Wiggly's lot, Sam took the and looked at them ruefully for a moment. "All this trouble," he thought. "All this trouble over an outdated book of poems and a self-help manual for fledgling public speakers." Except, of course, that wasn't what it was about. It had never been about the books at all. He stripped the rubber band from his wrist and put it around the books. Then he took out his wallet, removed a $5 bill from his dwindling supply of ready cash, and slipped it beneath the elastic.
"What's that for?"
"The fine. What I owe on these two, and one other from a long time ago. The Black Arrow by Robert Louis Stevenson. This ends it." He put the books on the console between the two bucket seats and took a package of red licorice out of his pocket. He tore it open, and that old sugary smell struck him at once, with the force of a hard slap. From his nose it seemed to go directly into his head, and from his head it plummeted into his stomach, which immediately cramped into a slick, hard fist. For one awful moment, he thought he was going to vomit in his own lap. Apparently some things never changed. Nonetheless, he continued opening packages of red licorice, making a bundle of limber, waxy-textured candy whips. Naomi slowed as the light at the next intersection turned red, then stopped, although Sam could not see another car moving in either direction. Rain and wind lashed at her little car. They were now only 4 blocks from the library. Sam, what on earth are you doing? And because he didn't really know what on earth he was doing, he said, If fear is Ardelia's meat, Naomi, we have to find the other thing. The thing that's the opposite of fear. Because that, whatever it is, will be her poison. So, what do you think that thing might be? Well, I doubt if it's red licorice. He gestured impatiently. How can you be so sure? Crosses are supposed to kill vampires, the blood-sucking kind. But a cross is only 2 sticks of wood or metal set at right angles to each other. Maybe a head of lettuce would work just as well, if it was turned on. The light turned green. If it was an energized head of lettuce, Naomi said thoughtfully, driving on. Right. Sam held up a half dozen long red whips. All I know is that this is what I have. Maybe it's ludicrous. Probably is. But I don't care. It's a by-God symbol of all the things my library policeman took away from me. The love, the friendship, the sense of belonging. I've felt like an outsider all my life, Naomi, and never knew why. And now I do. This is just another of the things he took away. I used to love this stuff. Now I can barely stand the smell of it. That's okay. I can deal with that. But I have to know how to turn it on. Sam began to roll the licorice whips between his palms, gradually turning them into a sticky ball. He had thought the smell was the worst thing with which the red licorice could test him. But he had been wrong. The texture was worse. And the dye was coming off on his palms and fingers, turning them a sinister dark red. He went on, nevertheless, stopping only to add the contents of another fresh package to the soft mass every 30 seconds or so. Maybe I'm looking too hard, he said. Maybe it's plain old bravery that's the opposite of fear. Courage, if you want a fancier word. Is that it? Is that all? Is bravery the difference between Naomi and Sarah? She looked startled. Are you asking me if quitting drinking was an act of bravery? I don't know what I'm asking, he said. But I think you're in the right neighborhood, at least. I don't need to ask about fear. I know what that is. Fear is an emotion which encloses and precludes change. Was it an act of bravery when you gave up drinking? I never really gave it up, she said. That isn't how alcoholics do it. They can't do it that way. You employ a lot of sideways thinking instead. One day at a time, easy does it. Live and let live, all that. But the center of it is this. You give up believing you can control your drinking. That idea was a myth you told yourself. And that's what you give up. The myth. You tell me. Is that bravery? Of course. But it's sure not foxhole bravery. Foxhole bravery, she said and laughed. I like that. But you're right. What I do, what we do, to keep away from the first one, is not that kind of bravery. In spite of movies like The Lost Weekend, I think what we do is pretty undramatic. Sam was remembering the dreadful apathy which had settled over him after he had been raped in the bushes at the side of the Briggs Avenue branch of the St. Louis Library. Raped by a man who had called himself a policeman. That had been pretty undramatic, too. Just a dirty trick. That was all it had been. A dirty, brainless trick played on a little kid by a man with serious mental problems. Sam supposed that, when you counted up the whole score, he ought to have called himself lucky. The library cop might have killed him. Ahead of them, the round white globes which marked the Junction City Public Library glimmered in the rain. Naomi said hesitantly, I think the real opposite of fear might be honesty. Honesty and belief. How does that sound?
Honesty and belief, he said quietly, tasting the words. He squeezed the sticky ball of red licorice in his right hand. Not bad, I guess. Anyway, they'll have to do. We're here.
The glimmering green numbers of the car's dashboard clock read 7:57. They had made it before 8, after all. Maybe we'd better wait and make sure everybody's gone before we go around back, she said.
I think that's a very good idea.
They cruised into an empty parking space across the street from the library's entrance. The globes shimmered delicately in the rain. The rustle of the trees was a less delicate thing. The wind was still gaining strength. The oaks sounded as if they were dreaming, and all the dreams were bad. At 8:02, a van with a stuffed Garfield cat and a mom's taxi sign in its rear window pulled up across from them. The horn honked, and the library's door, looking less grim even in this light than it had on Sam's first visit to the library, less like the mouth in the head of a vast granite robot, opened at once. Three kids, junior high schoolers by the look of them, came out and hurried down the steps. As they ran down the walk to Mom's taxi, two of them pulled their jackets up to shield their heads from the rain. The van's side door rumbled open on its track, and the kids piled into it. Sam could hear the faint sound of their laughter and envied the sound. He thought about how good it must be to come out of a library with laughter in your mouth. He had missed that experience, thanks to the man in the round black glasses. Honesty, he thought. Honesty and belief. And then he thought again. The fine is paid. The fine is paid, goddammit. He ripped open the last two packages of licorice and began kneading their contents into his sticky, nasty-smelling red ball. He glanced at the rear of Mom's taxi as he did so. He could see white exhaust drifting up and tattering in the windy air. Suddenly he began to realize what he was up to here. Once, when I was in high school, he said, I watched a bunch of kids play a prank on this other kid they didn't like. In those days, watching was what I did best. They took a wad of modeling clay from the art room and stuffed it in the tailpipe of a kid's Pontiac. You know what happened? She glanced at him doubtfully. No. What? Blew the muffler off in two pieces, he said. One on each side of the car. They flew like shrapnel. The muffler was the weak point, you see. I suppose if the gases had backflowed all the way to the engine, they might have blown the cylinders right out of the block.
Sam, what are you talking about?
Hope, he said. I'm talking about hope. I guess the honesty and belief have to come a little later.
Mom's taxi pulled away from the curb, its headlights spearing through the silvery lines of rain. The green numbers on Naomi's dashboard clock read 8:06 when the library's front door opened again. A man and a woman came out. The man, awkwardly buttoning his overcoat with an umbrella tucked under his arm, was unmistakably Richard Price. Sam knew him at once, even though he had only seen a single photo of the man in an old newspaper. The girl was Cynthia Berrigan, the library assistant he had spoken to on Saturday night. Price said something to the girl. Sam thought she laughed. He was suddenly aware that he was sitting bolt upright in the bucket seat of Naomi's Datsun, every muscle creaking with tension. He tried to make himself relax and discovered he couldn't do it.
Now, why doesn't that surprise me? He thought.
Price raised his umbrella. The two of them hurried down the walk beneath it, the Berrigan girl tying a plastic rain kerchief over her hair as they came. They separated at the foot of the walk, Price going to an old Impala the size of a cabin cruiser, the Berrigan girl to a Yugo parked half a block down. Price U-turned in the street. Naomi ducked down a little, startled, as the headlights shone briefly into her own car. and blipped his horn at the Yugo as he passed it. Cynthia Berrigan blipped hers in return, then drove away in the opposite direction. Now there was only them, the library, and possibly Ardelia, waiting for them someplace inside, along with Sam's old friend, the library policeman. Naomi drove slowly around the block to Wegman Street. About halfway down on the left, a discreet sign marked a small break in the hedge. It read, "Library Deliveries Only." A gust of wind strong enough to rock the Datsun on its springs struck them, rattling rain against the windows so hard that it sounded like sand. Somewhere nearby, there was a splintering crack as either a large branch or a small tree gave way. This was followed by a thud, as whatever it was fell into the street. "God," Naomi said in a thin, distressed voice, "I don't like this." "I'm not crazy about it myself," Sam agreed, but he had barely heard her. He was thinking about how that modeling clay had looked, how it had looked bulging out of the tailpipe of the kid's car. It had looked like a blister. Naomi turned in at the sign. They drove up a short lane into a small paved loading-unloading area. A single orange arc sodium lamp hung over the little square of pavement. It cast a strong, penetrating light, and the moving branches of the oaks which ringed the loading zone danced crazy shadows onto the rear face of the building in its glow. For a moment, two of these shadows seemed to coalesce at the foot of the platform, making a shape that was almost man-like. It looked as if someone had been waiting under there, someone who was now crawling out to greet them. In just a second or two, Sam thought, the orange glare from that overhead light will strike his glasses, his little round black glasses, and he will look through the windshield at me. Not at Naomi, just at me. He'll look at me, and he'll say,
"Hello, son. I've been waiting for you. All these years, I've been waiting for you. Come with me now. Come with me, because I'm a policeman."
There was another loud, splintering crack, and a tree branch dropped to the pavement not 3 feet from the Datsun's trunk, exploding chunks of bark and rot-infested wood in every direction. If it landed on top of the car, it would have smashed the roof in like a tomato soup can. Naomi screamed. The wind, still rising, screamed back. Sam was reaching for her, meaning to put a comforting arm around her, when the door at the rear of the loading platform opened part way, and Dave Duncan stepped into the gap. He was holding onto the door to keep the wind from snatching it out of his grasp. To Sam, the old man's face looked far too white and almost grotesquely frightened. He made frantic, beckoning gestures with his free hand.
"Naomi, there's Dave."
"Where?" "Oh, yes. I see him."
Her eyes widened.
"My God, he looks horrible."
She began to open her door. The wind gusted, ripped it out of her grasp, and whooshed through the Datsun in a tight little tornado, lifting the licorice wrappers and dancing them around in dizzy circles. Naomi managed to get one hand down just in time to keep from being struck, and perhaps injured, by the rebound of her own car door. Then she was out, her hair blowing in its own storm about her head, her skirt soaked and painted against her thighs in a moment. Sam shoved his own door open. The wind was blowing the wrong way for him, and he did literally have to put his shoulder to it and struggled out. He had time to wonder where in the hell this storm had come from. The Prince of Piggly Wiggly had said there had been no prediction for such a spectacular capful of wind and rain. Just showers, he'd said. Ardelia. Maybe it was Ardelia's storm. As if to confirm this, Dave's voice rose in a momentary lull.
"Hurry up. I can smell her goddamn perfume everywhere."
Sam found the idea that the smell of Ardelia's perfume might somehow precede her materialization obscurely terrifying. He was halfway to the loading platform steps before he realized that although he still had the snot-textured ball of red licorice, he had left the books in the car. He turned back, muscled the door open, and got them. As he did, the quality of the light changed. It went from a bright, penetrating orange to white. Sam saw the change on the skin of his hands, and for a moment his eyes seemed to freeze in their sockets. He backed out of the car in a hurry, the books in his hand, and whirled around. The orange arc sodium security lamp was gone. It had been replaced by an old-fashioned mercury vapor streetlight. The trees dancing and groaning around the loading platform in the wind were thicker now. Stately old elms predominated, easily overtopping the oaks. The shape of the loading platform had changed, and now tangled runners of ivy climbed the rear wall of the library, a wall which had been bare just a moment ago. Welcome to 1960, Sam thought. Welcome to the Ardelia Lortz edition of the Junction City Public Library. Naomi had gained the platform. She was saying something to Dave. Dave replied, then looked back over his shoulder. His body jerked. At the same moment, Naomi screamed. Sam ran for the steps to the platform, the tail of his coat billowing out behind him. As he climbed the steps, he saw a white hand float out of the darkness and settle on Dave's shoulder. It yanked him back into the library. "Grab the door," Sam screamed. "Naomi, grab the door. Don't let it lock." But in this, the wind helped them. It blew the door wide open, striking Naomi's shoulder and making her stagger backward. Sam reached it in time to catch it on the rebound. Naomi turned horrified, dark eyes on him.
"It was the man who came to your house, Sam. The tall man with the silvery eyes. I saw him. He grabbed Dave."
"No time to think about it. Come on." He slipped an arm around Naomi's waist and pulled her forward into the library. Behind them, the wind dropped and the door slammed shut with a thud. They were in a book cataloging area, which was dim but not entirely dark. A small table lamp with a red fringe shade stood on the librarian's desk. The stacks began beyond this area, which was littered with boxes and packing materials. The latter consisted of crumpled newspapers, Sam saw. This was 1960, and those polyethylene popcorn balls hadn't been invented yet. Standing in one of the aisles, walled in with books on both sides, was the library policeman. He had Dave Duncan in a half Nelson and was holding him with almost absent ease, 3 inches off the floor. He looked at Sam and Naomi. His silver eyes glinted, and a crescent grin rose on his white face. It looked like a chrome moon.
"Not a step closer," he said, "or I'll snap his neck like a chicken bone. You'll hear it go."
Sam considered this, but only for a moment. He could smell lavender sachet, thick and cloying. Outside the building, the wind whined and boomed. The library policeman's shadow danced up the wall, as gaunt as a gantry. "He didn't have a shadow before," Sam realized. "What does that mean?" Maybe it meant the library policeman was more real now, more here, because Ardelia and the library policeman and the dark man in the old car were really the same person. There was only one, and these were simply the faces it wore, putting them on and taking them off again with the ease of a kid trying on Halloween masks.
"Am I supposed to think you'll let him live if we stand away from you?" he asked. "Bullshit."
He began to walk toward the library policeman. An expression which sat oddly on the tall man's face now appeared. It was surprise. He took a step backward. His trench coat flapped around his shins and dragged against the folio volumes which formed the sides of the narrow aisle in which he stood.
"I'm warning you."
"Warn and be damned,"
Sam said. Your argument isn't with him. You've got a bone to pick with me, don't you? Okay. Let's pick it.
The librarian has a score to settle with the old man, the policeman said, and took another step backward.
Something odd was happening to his face, and it took Sam an instant to see what it was. The silver light in the library policeman's eyes was fading. Then let her settle it, Sam said. My score is with you, big boy, and it goes back 30 years. He passed beyond the pool of radiance thrown by the table lamp.
All right, then,
the library cop snarled. He made a half turn and threw Dave Duncan down the aisle. Dave flew like a bag of laundry, a single croak of fear and surprise escaping him. He tried to raise one arm as he approached the wall, but it was only a dazed, half-hearted reflex. He collided with the fire extinguisher mounted by the stairs, and Sam heard the dull crunch of a breaking bone. Dave fell, and the heavy red extinguisher fell off the wall on top of him.
Dave!
Naomi shrieked and darted toward him.
Naomi, no!
But she paid no attention. The library policeman's grin reappeared. He grabbed Naomi by the arm as she tried to go past and curled her to him. His face came down and was for a moment hidden by the chestnut-colored hair at the nape of her neck. He uttered a strange, muffled cough against her flesh, and then began kissing her, or so it appeared. His long white hand dug into her upper arm. Naomi screamed again, and then seemed to slump a little in his grip. Sam had reached the entrance to the stacks now. He seized the first book his hand touched, yanked it off the shelf, cocked his arm back, and threw it. It flew end over end, the board spreading, the pages riffling, and struck the library policeman on the side of the head. He uttered a cry of rage and surprise and looked up. Naomi tore free of his grasp and staggered sideways into one of the high shelves, flagging her arms for balance. The shelf rocked back as she rebounded and then fell with a gigantic, echoing crash. Books flew off the shelves where they might have stood undisturbed for years and struck the floor in a rain of slaps that sounded oddly like applause. Naomi ignored this. She reached Dave and fell on her knees beside him, crying his name over and over. The library policeman turned in that direction.
Your argument isn't with her either, Sam said.
The library policeman turned back to him. His silver eyes had been replaced with small black glasses that gave his face a blind, mole-like look.
I should have killed you the first time, he said,
and began to walk toward Sam. His walk was accompanied by a queer brushing sound. Sam looked down and saw the hem of the library cop's trench coat was now brushing the floor. He was growing shorter.
The fine is paid, Sam said quietly.
The library policeman stopped. Sam held up the books with the $5 bill beneath the elastic.
The fine is paid, and the books are returned. It's all over, you bitch, or bastard, or whatever you are.
Outside, the wind rose in a long, hollow cry which ran beneath the eaves like glass. The library policeman's tongue crept out and licked his lips. It was very red, very pointed. Blemishes had begun to appear on his cheeks and forehead. There was a greasy lens of sweat on his skin, and the smell of lavender sachet was much stronger.
Wrong, the library policeman cried. Wrong. Those aren't the books you borrowed. I know. That drunk old cocksucker took the books you borrowed. They were
destroyed, Sam finished. He began to walk again, closing in on the library policeman, and the lavender smell grew stronger with every step he took. His heart was racing in his chest.
I know whose idea that was, too. But these are perfectly acceptable replacements. Take them.
His voice rose into a stern shout.
Take them, damn you.
He held the books out, and the library policeman, looking confused and afraid, reached for them. "No, not like that," Sam said, raising the books above the white, grasping hand. "Like this." He brought the books down in the library policeman's face, brought them down hard. He could not remember ever feeling such sublime satisfaction in his life as that which he felt when best-loved poems of the American people and the speaker's companion struck and broke the library policeman's nose. The round black glasses flew off his face and fell to the floor. Beneath them were black sockets lined with a bed of whitish fluid. Tiny threads floated up from this oozy stuff, and Sam thought about Dave's story.
"Looked like it was starting to grow its own skin," he had said.
The library policeman screamed.
"You can't,"
it screamed.
"You can't hurt me. You're afraid of me. Besides, you liked it. You liked it. You dirty little boy. You liked it."
"Wrong," Sam said. "I fucking hated it. Now take these books. Take them and get out of here, because the fine is paid." He slammed the books into the library policeman's chest, and as the library policeman's hands closed on them, Sam hoiked one knee squarely into the library policeman's crotch. "That's for all the other kids," he said. "The ones you fucked and the ones she ate." The creature wailed with pain. His flailing hands dropped the books as he bent to cup his groin. His greasy black hair fell over his face, mercifully hiding those blank, thread-choked sockets. "Of course they are blank," Sam had time to think. "I never saw the eyes behind the glasses he wore that day, so she couldn't see them either." "That doesn't pay your fine," Sam said, "but it's a step in the right direction, isn't it?" The library policeman's trench coat began to writhe and ripple, as if some unimaginable transformation had begun beneath it. And when it, looked up, Sam saw something which drove him back a step in horror and revulsion. The man who had come half from Dave's poster and half from Sam's own mind had become a misshapen dwarf. The dwarf was becoming something else. A dreadful, hermaphroditic creature. A sexual storm was happening on its face and beneath the bunching, twitching trench coat. Half the hair was still black. The other half was ash blonde. One socket was still empty. A savage blue eye glittered hate from the other.
"I want you," the dwarfish creature hissed. "I want you, and I'll have you."
"Try me, Ardelia," Sam said. "Let's rock and roll." He reached for the thing before him, but screamed and withdrew his hand as soon as it snagged in the trench coat. It wasn't a coat at all. It was some sort of dreadful loose skin, and it was like trying to grip a mass of freshly used tea bags. It scuttered up the canted side of the fallen bookshelf and thumped into the shadows on the far side. The smell of lavender sachet was suddenly much stronger. A brutal laugh drifted up from the shadows. A woman's laugh.
"Too late, Sam," she said. "It's already too late. The deed is done."
"Ardelia's back," Sam thought. And from outside there was a tremendous rending crash. The building shuddered as a tree fell against it. And the lights went out. They were in total darkness only for a second, but it seemed much longer. Ardelia laughed again, and this time her laughter had a strange hooting quality, like laughter broadcast through a megaphone. Then a single emergency bulb high up on one wall went on, throwing a pallid sheaf of light across this section of the stacks, and flinging shadows everywhere, like tangles of black yarn. Sam could hear the light's battery buzzing noisily. He made his way to where Naomi still knelt beside Dave, twice almost falling as his feet slid in piles of books which had spilled from the overturned case. Naomi looked up at him. Her face was white and shocked and streaked with tears.
Sam, I think he's dying.
He knelt beside Dave. The old man's eyes were shut, and he was breathing in harsh, almost random gasps. Thin trickles of blood spilled from both nostrils and from one ear. There was a deep, crushed dent in his forehead, just above the right eyebrow. Looking at it made Sam's stomach clench. One of Dave's cheekbones was clearly broken, and the fire extinguisher's handle was printed on that side of his face in bright lines of blood and bruise. It looked like a tattoo.
We've got to get him to a hospital, Sam.
Do you think she'd let us out of here now? He asked. And as if in answer to this question, a huge book, the T volume of the Oxford English Dictionary, came flying at them from behind the rough circle of light thrown by the emergency unit mounted on the wall. Sam pulled Naomi backward, and they both went sprawling in the dusty aisle. 7 pounds of Tabasco, Tendril, Tomcat, and Trepan slammed through the space where Naomi's head had been a moment before, hit the wall, and splashed to the floor in an untidy, tented heap. From the shadows came shrill laughter. Sam rose to his knees in time to see a hunched shape flit down the aisle beyond the fallen bookcase.
It's still changing, Sam thought. Into what, God only knows.
It button-hooked to the left and was gone.
Get her, Sam,
Naomi said hoarsely. She gripped one of his hands.
Get her. Please, get her.
I'll try, he said.
He stepped over Dave's sprawled legs and entered the deeper shadows beyond the overturned bookcase.
The smell freaked him out. The smell of lavender sachet mixed with the dusty aroma of books from all those latter years. That smell mingled with the freight train whoop of the wind outside. Made him feel like H.G. Wells' time traveler, and the library itself, bulking all around him, was his time machine. He walked slowly down the aisle, squeezing the ball of red licorice nervously in his left hand. Books surrounded him, seemed to frown down at him. They climbed to a height that was twice his own. He could hear the click and squeak of his shoes on the old linoleum.
"Where are you?" he shouted. If you want me, Ardelia, why don't you come on and get me? I'm right here.
No answer. But she would have to come out soon, wouldn't she? If Dave was right, her change was upon her, and her time was short.
Midnight, he thought. The library policeman gave me until midnight. So maybe that's how long she has. But that's over 3.5 hours away. Dave can't possibly wait that long. Then another thought, even less pleasant, occurred. Suppose that, while he was mucking around back here in those dark aisles, Ardelia was circling her way back to Naomi and Dave. He came to the end of the aisle, listened, heard nothing, and slipped over into the next. It was empty. He heard a low whispering sound from above him and looked up just in time to see half a dozen heavy books sliding out from one of the shelves above his head. He lunged backward with a cry as the books fell, striking his thighs, and heard Ardelia's crazy laughter from the other side of the bookcase. He could imagine her up there, clinging to the shelves like a spider bloated with poison, and his body seemed to act before his brain could think. He slewed around on his heels like a drunken soldier trying to do an about-face and threw his back against the shelf. The laughter turned to a scream of fear and surprise as the stack tilted under Sam's weight. He heard a meaty thud as the thing hurled itself from its perch. A second later, the stack went over. What happened then was something Sam had not foreseen.
The stack he had pushed toppled across the aisle, shedding its books in a waterfall as it went, and struck the next one. The second fell against the third against the fourth, and then they were all falling like dominoes, all the way across this huge, shadowy storage area, crashing and clanging and spilling everything from Mariette's works to the complete Grimm's fairy tales. He heard Ardelia scream again, and then Sam launched himself at the tilted bookcase he had pushed over. He climbed it like a ladder, kicking books out of his way in search of toeholds, yanking himself upward with one hand. He threw himself down on the far side and saw a white, hellishly misshapen creature pulling itself from beneath a jackstraw tumble of atlases and travel volumes. It had blonde hair and blue eyes, but any resemblance to humanity ceased there. Its illusions were gone. The creature was a fat, naked thing, with arms and legs that appeared to end in jointed claws. A sack of flesh hung below its neck like a deflated goiter. Thin white fibers stormed around its body. There was something horridly beetle-like about it, and Sam was suddenly screaming inside. Silent, atavistic screams which seemed to radiate out along his bones.
This is it. God help me, this is it.
He felt revulsion, but suddenly his terror was gone. Now that he could actually see the thing, it was not so bad. Then it began to change again, and Sam's feeling of relief faded. It did not have a face, exactly, but below the bulging blue eyes, a horn shape began to extrude itself, pushing out of the horror show face like a stubby elephant's trunk. The eyes stretched away to either side, becoming first Chinese and then insectile. Sam could hear it sniffing as it stretched toward him. It was covered with wavering, dusty threads. Part of him wanted to pull back, was screaming at him to pull back, but most of them wanted to stand his ground. And as the thing's fleshy proboscis touched him, Sam felt its deep power. A sense of lethargy filled him, a feeling that it would be better if he just stood still and let it happen. The wind had become a distant, dreamy howl. It was soothing, in a way, as the sound of the vacuum cleaner had been soothing when he was very small. Sam? Naomi called, but her voice was distant, unimportant. Sam? Are you all right? Had he thought he'd loved her? That was silly. Quite ridiculous when you thought about it. When you got right down to it, this was much better. This creature had stories to tell. Very interesting stories. The white thing's entire plastic body now yearned toward the proboscis. It fed itself into itself, and the proboscis elongated. The creature became a single tube-shaped thing, the rest of its body hanging as useless and forgotten as that sack below its neck had hung. All its vitality was invested in the horn of flesh, the conduit through which it would suck Sam's vitality and essence into itself. And it was nice. The proboscis slipped gently up Sam's legs, pressed briefly against his groin, then rose higher, caressing his belly. Sam fell on his knees to give it access to his face. He felt his eyes sting briefly and pleasantly, as some fluid, not tears, this was thicker than tears, began to ooze from them. The proboscis closed in on his eyes. He could see a pink petal of flesh opening and closing hungrily inside there. Each time it opened, it revealed a deeper darkness beyond. Then it clenched, forming a hole in the petal, a tube within a tube, and it slipped with sensual slowness across his lips and cheek toward that sticky outflow. Misshapen dark blue eyes gazed at him hungrily.
But the fine
was paid. Summoning every last bit of his strength, Sam clamped his right hand over the proboscis. It was hot and noxious. The tiny threads of flesh which covered it stung his palm. It jerked and tried to draw back. For a moment, Sam almost lost it, and then he closed his hand in a fist, digging his fingernails into the meat of the thing. "Here," he shouted. "Here, I've got something for you, bitch. I brought it all the way from East St. Louis." He brought his left hand around and slammed the sticky ball of red licorice into the end of the proboscis, plugging it the way the kids in that long-ago parking lot had plugged the tailpipe of Tommy Reed's Pontiac. It tried to shriek and could produce only a blocked humming sound. Then it tried again to pull itself away from Sam. The ball of red licorice bulged from the end of its convulsing snout like a blood blister. Sam struggled to his knees, still holding the twitching, noisome flesh in his hand, and threw himself on top of the Ardelia thing. It twisted and pulsed beneath him, trying to throw him off. They rolled over and over in the heaped pile of books. It was dreadfully strong. Once Sam was eye to eye with it, he was nearly frozen by the hate and panic in that gaze. Then he felt it begin to swell. He let go and scrambled backward, gasping. The thing in the book-littered aisle now looked like a grotesque beach ball with a trunk, a beach ball covered with fine hair, which wavered like tendrils of seaweed in a running tide. It rolled over in the aisle, its proboscis swelling like a fire hose which has been tied in a knot. Sam watched, frozen with horror and fascination, as the thing which had called itself Ardelia Lortz strangled on its own fuming guts. Bright red roadmap lines of blood popped out on its straining hide. Its eyes bulged, now staring at Sam in an expression of dazed surprise. It made one final effort to expel the soft blob of licorice, but its proboscis had been wide open in its anticipation of food, and the licorice stayed put. Sam saw what was going to happen and threw an arm over his face an instant before it exploded. Chunks of alien flesh flew in every direction. Ropes of thick blood splattered Sam's arms, chest, and legs. He cried out in mingled revulsion and relief. An instant later, the emergency light winked out, plunging them into darkness again. Once more, the interval of darkness was very brief, but it was long enough for Sam to sense the change. He felt it in his head, a clear sensation of things which had been out of joint snapping back into place. When the emergency lights came back on, there were four of them. Their batteries made a low, self-satisfied humming sound instead of a loud buzz, and they were very bright, banishing the shadows to the furthest corners of the room. He did not know if the world of 1960 they had entered, when the arc sodium light became a mercury vapor lamp, had been real or an illusion. But he knew it was gone. The overturned bookcases were upright again. There was a litter of books in the aisle, a dozen or so, but he might have knocked those off himself in his struggle to get to his feet. And outside, the sound of the storm had fallen from a shout to a mutter. Sam could hear what sounded like a very sedate rain falling on the roof. The Ardelia thing was gone. There were no splatters of blood or chunks of flesh on the floor, on the books, or on him. There was only one sign of her, a single golden earring glinting up at him. Sam got shakily to his feet and kicked it away. Then a grayness came over his sight, and he swayed on his feet,
eyes closed, waiting to see if he would faint or not. Sam? It was Naomi, and she sounded as if she were crying. Sam, where are you? Here. He reached up, grabbed a handful of his hair, and pulled it hard. Stupid, probably, but it worked. The wavery grayness didn't go away entirely, but it retreated. He began moving back toward the cataloging area, walking in large, careful strides. The same desk, a graceless block of wood on stubby legs, stood in the cataloging area, but the lamp with its old-fashioned tassel shade had been replaced with a fluorescent bar. The battered typewriter and Rolodex had been replaced by an Apple computer. And if he had not already been sure of what time he was now in, a glance at the cardboard cartons on the floor would have convinced him. They were full of poppers and plastic bubble strips. Naomi was still kneeling beside Dave at the end of the aisle, and when Sam reached her side, he saw that the fire extinguisher, although 30 years had passed, it appeared to be the same one, was firmly mounted on its post again, but the shape of its handle was still imprinted on Dave's cheek and forehead. His eyes were open, and when he saw Sam, he smiled.
Not bad, he whispered. I'll bet you didn't know you had it in you.
Sam felt a tremendous, buoyant sense of relief. No, he said. I didn't. He bent down and held 3 fingers in front of Dave's eyes. How many fingers do you see?
About 74, Dave whispered.
I'll call the ambulance, Naomi said, and started to get up. Dave's left hand grasped her wrist before she could.
No, not yet.
His eyes shifted to Sam.
Bend down. I need to whisper.
Sam bent over the old man. Dave put a trembling hand on the back of his neck. His lips tickled the cup of Sam's ear, and Sam had to force himself to hold steady. It tickled.
Sam, he whispered. She waits. Remember? She waits. What?
Sam asked. He felt almost totally unstrung.
Dave, what do you mean?
But Dave's hand had fallen away. He stared up at Sam, through Sam, his chest rising shallowly and rapidly. I'm going, Naomi said, clearly upset. There's a telephone down there on the cataloging desk.
No,
Sam said. She turned toward him, eyes glaring, mouth pulled back from neat white teeth in a fury. What do you mean, no? Are you crazy? His skull is fractured at the very least.
He's going, Sarah, Sam said gently. Very soon. Stay with him. Be his friend.
She looked down, and this time she saw what Sam had seen. The pupil of Dave's left eye had drawn down to a pinpoint. The pupil of his right was huge and fixed.
Dave? She whispered, frightened. Dave?
But Dave was looking at Sam again.
Remember, he whispered. She would.
His eyes grew still and fixed. His chest rose once more, dropped, and did not rise again. Naomi began to sob. She put his hand against her cheek and closed his eyes. Sam knelt down painfully and put his arm around her waist.